And the first case on calendar today is case number 58612, Schmutz versus Bradford. Justice Seda is unavoidably absent today, and she will be listening to the audio transcript of this proceeding. She'll participate in the decision. She could not be here today. And we have Justice Perry in the Regional Justice Center in Las Vegas. Sometimes the acoustics can be challenging on these video participations, so bear with us if we do have any kind of auditory problems. All right, is counsel ready to proceed? Please do. And let us know if you want to reserve any time for rebuttal.
Your Honor, 2 minutes.
2 minutes?
2 minutes, yes. My name is Justin Stovall. I represent the appellants. This is a straightforward appeal from a successful motion for summary judgment in the trial court that happens to implicate an interesting procedural issue. And that procedural issue is whether or not wrongful death claims and a survival action can be pled in the alternative. Now, the first issue, and perhaps a threshold issue, is whether or not it was error for the district court to grant the defendant's motion for summary judgment. The breach that we're speaking about in this case is the defendant's failure to recognize cancer in a radiological note and report. The question is whether or not this breach caused the death of the appellant, Clark Schmutz. We believe there were genuine issues of material fact that should have precluded this summary judgment order.
Mr. Stovall, can I here in Las Vegas,
yes, sir.
Let me ask you a question. Was there a 56F application made for further discovery?
There was. Judge Kadish, in the first motion for summary judgment, gave the plaintiffs leave to add another affidavit that opined as to the cause of death and that was specific to the defendant doctor's specialties. So there was an opportunity. There were two summary judgment motions. One, we were granted leave to amend our complaint and to add an additional affidavit. And then the second one, the defendants were successful on.
And then did you make a proffer as to what you would have been able to come up with if you were allowed further discovery in the second motion? What could you have come up with to support your causation?
In addition to what our doctors were able to say, and that's that the lack of palliative care and that the excruciating pain that Mr. Schmutz went through was a cause of death. It both increased his morbidity and was the exact proximate cause of death. The other proffer of issues, and I don't know, the transcript of the motion for summary judgment comes to mind, but I don't know if it was actually issued. But there is a record of treating physicians that could have opined that the misdiagnosis or the breach, the defendant's breach, caused the death, and also the death certificate said that bone cancer was the cause of death. And so
I thought I saw something in the record that indicated that death certificate was voided. Is that incorrect?
I didn't catch the last word. The death certificate was what, Your Honor?
Was voided or somehow changed for the cause of death? Is that I could be mistaken.
I can't make a representation to the court, Your Honor. So
you've answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So it's important to keep in mind that the medical care that the defendants were engaged in that gave rise to this medical malpractice action was a review of radiological notes. The plaintiff's experts, Knott, Frazier, and Fink, were all competent to testify as to the general duty of a physician to review radiological notes. Dr. Knott and Dr. Frazier both opined that the defendant's breaches caused increased morbidity and were the proximate cause of death. It's important to remember, it's an important distinction, I think, that shortening a person's life, for example, by allowing them to, by failing to give them palliative care and allowing them to experience excruciating pain, which is a comorbidity, is the same thing as causing death. So that is our argument. We believe that the that as a threshold matter, or as a first matter, that the district court erred in dismissing the plaintiff's wrongful death claims. Now, this is probably a good point to address the res ipsa issue. We made that as a backstop against any. We made that argument as a backstop against any contention that Dr. Siebel could possibly make that our affidavits were insufficient. Now, I believe we do have standing to raise that issue on appeal, despite the respondents' contentions, because we had made an issue of the surgical or the medical procedure that was conducted on the wrong part of the body from the very beginning of this case. And I was also thinking about it. The court could also consider that using plain error standard because it was so obvious. But the reason we addressed that in our appeal is just as a backstop against any argument that Dr. Siebel may make that our affidavits weren't sufficient. This is also probably a good point to address our loss of consortium.
Could I ask you on the res ipsa, did you discuss res ipsa at all in district court, or how I just want to get that clarified. Is it just discussed on appeal for the first time?
The word res ipsa, I guess, was raised for the first time on appeal. Now, our argument, obviously, is that they were on notice, that we are claiming that he did a surgical procedure on the wrong part of Mr. Schmutz's body the entire time.
Well, the key to the res ipsa argument is if you made out a case where you may not have had to do the affidavit, you know, like that on that particular issue, but you got to make that argument, don't you, in district court, you know, in order to proceed, you know, it can't be presumed, you know.
I believe, and this may not be the strongest argument, but I believe there is an argument that under that Western Tex case that that we mentioned in our in our reply brief, that because we had made an issue out of causation, that was part of our causation issue. And because we had, they were on, the respondents were on notice of that issue and throughout the entire proceeding, that they, that we should be able to raise that, and the court should be able to review that on appeal. And that's the best I can say for that argument. We did not, to answer your question, state res ipsa in the trial court.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So back to loss of consortium. Now, there is no parent-child loss of consortium cause of action in Nevada. The only way that the children of Clark Schmutz would be able to bring a loss of consortium claim is through the wrongful death statute. Okay, but there was some confusion because there is a common law cause of action for husband-wife loss of consortium, and I believe the gun law case mentions that, just one case offhand. So even if the wrongful death claim was properly dismissed, and if the court allows us to, or rules that it's proper to alternatively plead the medical negligence claim as a survival action, that loss of consortium claim for Margaret Schmutz should be reinstated in that case. So on to the next issue. If this court determines that the wrongful death claim was properly dismissed by the trial court, we believe that we should have been allowed to carry on with our medical negligence claim on behalf of, or the estate of Clark Schmutz should have been able to carry on that claim on his behalf. So that becomes a question of whether or not a plaintiff, and this is the important issue that I brought up at the beginning, whether or not a plaintiff can alternatively plead wrongful death claims under NRS 41.085 and plead in the alternative a claim under the survival statute, which is NRS 41.100. We're arguing that we can. So even if the district court did not find that the defendants caused Clark Schmutz to die, all right, They still subjected him to unnecessary medical treatments. They denied him the ability to receive palliative care or pain treatment. And they also denied him the opportunity to get his affairs in order before he died. And that would be the substance of the medical negligence claim, if we were allowed to plead that into the alternative. So we believe that the way that should work is that both claims should be able to be pled in the alternative, and that those claims should be taken to a jury, and the jury should be able to determine whether or not there was causation for the wrongful death as opposed to the medical negligence. Now,
so would that be the subject of a special interrogatory? Is that how you would approach that, or how would you judge sort out first the two claims and then damages with respect to the two claims?
I didn't mean to interrupt you. There are a couple ways you could do that. I think you asked me two questions there. And one, how would you ask that causation issue? I think the jury would, and I guess through a special interrogatory, have to determine whether the defendants caused death, right? And then they would find in favor of the plaintiff for the heir's wrongful death statute, or they would find that the causation of death laid with someone else, and then they would have to, then they would find in favor of the plaintiff on the survival statute claim. Now, there'd be different parties. The estate would, I suppose, be the winner in the survival action if cause was not proved, and I suppose the wife, Margaret Schmutz, on her loss of consortium claim. If they did find that there was causation, right, for the death, then it would be the heirs under the wrongful death statute.
Counsel, can I take you back to the affidavits? I'm a little concerned because reading this, and you may clarify it for me, but there was a motion to dismiss based upon the expert affidavit satisfying NRS 41A-071 requirements. There was a hearing. The district court denied the motion to dismiss, but allowed the affidavit, saying that the affidavits were inadequate, and allowing additional affidavits to be filed. Isn't that problematic because of our jurisprudence saying when affidavits for medical mal are inadequate, it's void ab initio?
Well, I can fall back on, Your Honor, to answer that question, and the answer is no. I don't think that it was improper for the district court to allow us to amend those. But the precedent I can fall back on, and I believe it is the precedent here, is I believe the Borger case where the court said that, look, having no affidavit, right, invokes that statute's language that says shall be dismissed. But it's a different issue if the affidavits are insufficient. And I can tell you I can't quote directly from the order that Judge Kadish signed, but it did, I believe, quote Borger or another case that quoted Borger, saying that since the issue was the insufficiency of our affidavits, that she felt comfortable allowing us to amend them.
Counsel, as a follow-up to Justice Douglas's question, which expert or experts do you believe best support your contention that the medical negligence claim survives summary judgment?
I believe that all of the experts that we have disclosed, support the medical negligence claim. The question would be whether or not all of our experts support the wrongful death claim, because I don't think that Dr. Brazier actually said that
maybe I should be more specific. I think all of them talked about standard of care, but which of the medical experts offer causation testimony for medical negligence?
Dr. Knotts and Dr. Fink, I believe.
Okay.
And they both said that it caused increased morbidity. Two of our experts, just to clarify, two of our experts said that. One of our experts did. I believe I'm correct in saying that those two were. They both said that it was increased morbidity and the proximate mm-hmm. cause. And that was on our second set of affidavits. Those right. were amended.
But the affidavits also establish on the medical negligence claim, do they not, that the decedent, before his death, was in agonal pain, and that could have been avoided had the diagnosis been made earlier?
Yes.
In other words, what life he was had left was significantly damaged by the failure to correctly diagnose what ailed him.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that goes
back to your affidavits seem to say that.
Yes, they do. And that goes back to my original point, and I believe this is kind of the overall theme in the wrongful death claim, and that is that it doesn't take an oncologist to say that somebody is going to die early because they were in excruciating, horrible pain. And this is a very painful disease. So if I could just use my...
Well, I've got a question for you. I'm sorry. I'm not clear about Judge Kadish's ruling. In other words, why did she think the affidavits were insufficient for medical negligence for the MedMal?
I don't want to make the respondents a case for them, but I believe that the reason was that the in their depositions, our expert physicians, who are not oncologists or hematologists, said that they would defer the cause of death to an oncologist hematologist. But I still believe that's a genuine issue for the jury. We passed the 41A muster, right, and now it's a question for the jury.
Without the amendments, were the affidavits sufficient to get through a motion to dismiss for insufficient affidavits? That's the question I have.
I believe that the original affidavits set forth all the facts that were necessary. They may not have implicitly stated that it increased morbidity and was exactly the proximate cause of death. Now, I think that really boils down to which trial court judge is looking at that and what their view on how sufficient those affidavits need to be.
But even if they were insufficient, you feel that the case law, our jurisprudence, would allow you to amend?
Yes.
Without a dismissal?
I firmly believe that the precedent set, and I believe the case, I'm putting it out there, I believe the case is Borger, says that when you're dealing with insufficiency of an affidavit as opposed to the absence of an affidavit, that it's discretionary.
Counsel, the trial court judge in her order opines plaintiffs are granted leave to amend their complaint to include an affidavit or affidavits that comply with NRS 41A071. Specifically, plaintiff's amended complaint must include an affidavit from a doctor who is engaged in the type of treatment that Dr. Sebel was providing at the time he treated the decedent, so as to provide an opinion as to the standard of care of the doctor in Dr. Sebel's position at the time he treated the decedent. And additionally, it says the amended complaint must also contain a proper opinion as to causation of death in order for plaintiffs to maintain a claim for wrongful death against defendants. What's your response as to that specific language in the order? Because she's saying it does not comply, the affidavits that were submitted, with the basic requirement.
First of all, yes, Your Honor, that is my recollection of what that initial order said. In response to your second question, I believe that her order was written in response to their motion. What she was saying is that she was giving us leave. These are what she felt the shortcomings or the vulnerabilities in our case was, and that is what we would have to do, in her opinion, in her mind, to fortify our claim against the grounds they were using to try and dismiss it. And we did do all of those things, in my opinion. We added language to all the affidavits that said it was approximate cause of death, except for Brazier. I believe Fink and Knotts did that. And we added Dr. Brazier, who's an anesthesiologist.
Was Judge Katie satisfied against Bradford? Because it didn't. I don't think that Justice Douglas mentioned Bradford's name in there. In other words, was it okay for Bradford but not okay for Seibel?
That is, I wasn't there. But based on my review of the record, I believe that she was satisfied, and that's why we had to go out and get Dr. Brazier, who's an anesthesiologist, to add that opinion. So to answer your question, I believe she was satisfied. I don't know what was in her head, but her ruling and her order would lead me to believe that that
but
is.
But the finding did not mention Bradford's name.
Yes. And I believe I'm out of time.
Yes, you are.
All right. Thank you, guys.
I'll give you 2 minutes on rebuttal. We took up a lot of your time, and I'll add 5 minutes to your argument. We don't have one following you.
Okay. Good morning. I'm John Cotton here representing Dr. Michael Bradford. Christopher Rath is here for Dr. Seibel in Southwest. Since we have somewhat duplicate arguments, we've agreed that I'll just go ahead with most of them, and then if the court has any questions specific to Dr. Rath's client, that he would handle those at that point.
Could you clear up this thing about what Judge Kadish did?
That's just what I was going to do.
It's not confusing
Judge
to me.
Judge Kadish's ruling basically stated that there wasn't a pain management doctor opining against Dr. Seibel, who is a pain management doctor. I don't believe she ruled, nor do we assert, that the neurosurgeon was somehow incompetent to talk about standard of care as to Dr. Bradford. She was merely addressing the incompetency of the other doctors, family practice, and a neurosurgeon to talk about
standard of care. So the affidavit was sufficient as to Bradford?
Yes, Your Honor. And to answer the other questions that came up, specifically from Judge Perriger, there was no 56F application to supplement the record at all before the Judge Adair with a hematologist or oncologist, anyone competent to testify regarding the death, timing of death, or the outcome throughout the process. In addition, there wasn't any proffer at all made at the time of the hearing in order to establish a basis for 56F. So what Judge Adair had in front of her was strictly what had been presented in the briefs and pleadings at that time. Basically, Judge Adair had no choice but to dismiss the plaintiff's wrongful death claims. They didn't have any competent expert testimony regarding whether the doctor's alleged failure to diagnose caused the decedent's death or caused it to occur sooner or would have changed any of the outcome at all. They didn't put one doctor's up on deposition on those subjects. The mere fact that they filed affidavits with a conclusory statement in there about death or suffering doesn't make them competent on a motion for summary judgment. It would be functional equivalent if I submitted an affidavit saying I've tried a bunch of medical malpractice cases and in my opinion this caused the patient pain and caused his death. Well, if they took my deposition and found out that I knew nothing really about those areas, that I wasn't an oncologist, wasn't a hematologist, and that's submitted on a motion for summary judgment, that's what Judge Adair has to look at the entirety of what's before her as to whether or not affidavits or not, whether or not those three witnesses were competent to testify in that area. And each and every one of them, in their depositions, said they would defer to an oncologist, that they could not opine as to that the outcome would have been any different, and they couldn't opine that the death was caused by any inaction or action on the part of either of the defendants in this case. That's the hole in the gap that they've got here in this entire case. They don't have any causation testimony, competent causation testimony. In fact, it's 180 degrees the opposite, each of their experts conceding that they could not testify to that effect, and each of them stating that they would defer to a board-certified hematologist or oncologist.
What about the decedent's pain and suffering pre-death and the fact that failure timely to diagnose this and treat it pre-death, even if he was terminally ill by this record, caused him, it marred the remaining days he had in life?
There's no doctor who said that. In fact, the experts that we put up said that it wouldn't have changed anything at all. They don't have any testimony on the other side saying, well, he would have been pain-free in essence if he would have been given this medication. None of these three doctors treat these sorts of patients, people dying from cancer. They didn't have any testimony that said that his pain and suffering somehow would have been different, that he would have been alleviated. They didn't just have an expert to distinguish between what Dr. Seibel was treating, which was a severe chronic back problem, and any pain from the cancer itself. They have to prove that in order to get beyond the causation motion for summary judgment, and they simply did not. That having failed, basically they're dropped then out of 41085. It takes the wrongful death statute out of the picture. And when they testified, and each of the doctors testified, they couldn't testify about the outcome or the death. Look, Webster's Third Dictionary, outcome is something that comes out of or follows from an activity or process, a consequence, a result. What was the result of the purported or alleged failure to diagnose here. They tried to claim that it was pain and suffering. They tried to claim that it was the death. They weren't able to prove either one of those two facts. And with that failing, basically, no matter which theory or cause of action they want to argue here, res ipsa loquitur, 41-100, it doesn't really make any difference because each and every one of those causes of action still hinges on causation. Even if they were properly pled, even if on standard of care they were able to get around it with a res ipsa, they still have to show causation in a medical malpractice case. It's one of the cardinal events that you have to prove. And they didn't put any kind of testimony like that in front of Judge Adair. They theoretically could have had an oncologist or a hematologist say, in my opinion, treatment would have been different, the pain would have been different. In my opinion, he would have lived another year or so. But they didn't ask for that opportunity, and they didn't put that sort of evidence in front of the court.
I read in the briefs and that when the decedent was correctly diagnosed, the regimen changed in terms of how they were treating him, and that certainly his family submitted affidavits to the effect that the back procedures that he underwent caused him a great deal of pain, that those would not have been necessary if they had known that what he was suffering from was bone cancer rather than some kind of back problem. Is it your position that that doesn't create an issue of fact as to the decedent's pain and suffering? The fact that when it was identified, the whole pattern of care changed greatly, and according to his family, he seemed much less, his pain seemed to diminish. That's the impression I have from this record. Your point is that that's not sufficient to create an issue of fact on a medical negligence claim that theoretically survives 41-100, and the legal issue on 41-100 and 085 is an interesting one. But your point is this case doesn't present that statutory issue at all legitimately because there's just no evidence?
Right, I don't say it jokingly at all. I understand the affidavits they put in as family members. I give my example of me submitting an affidavit to that effect. To an extent, it's the, do you know anything about cancer? Do you know anything about pain from cancer versus back pain? No, but I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night. I mean, it's basically the same logic to that there is no background for these people to render an opinion because 41A100 specifically says must be supported by expert testimony as to not only liability but also the proximate cause of any injuries. It's very specific that it requires expert testimony, and none of the family members are expert in this area. They can't distinguish between his pain from chronic back problem and his cancer pain. They're simply, and not using a derogatory term, but incompetent legally to submit any kind of testimony that would avoid a motion for summary judgment.
What about the change in medical care once this was identified? Is that something we can look at as expert?
I don't believe we can because there's no expert that said that somehow or another if this change had occurred back here, it would have made a difference from an oncological or hematology standpoint in caring for a cancer patient and somehow or another would have alleviated whatever pain he had here. And, oh, by the way, the pain he had here wasn't from his back. It was from the cancer. You still need that tie. The whole thing has to be tied together somehow or another.
But when Dr. McNulty identified the problem, he changed the man's care, correct?
He sent the man out for a consult.
Okay, and then the record shows that whoever he went to was an oncologist who changed the care, correct?
And there was no deposition of that those people. There was no testimony from them that somehow the outcome would have changed. Again, they had the ability to do that. It's not my task, if you will, to go out and disprove.
Well, we don't have an affidavit from the doctor who provided the post-McNulty treatment.
No affidavits, no deposition testimony, nothing at all, not even a letter that would indicate that. In fact, if you want to talk about letters, I think it's at page 525 of the transcript. There's a letter from Mr. Stovall acknowledging to another doctor witness he's sending a letter out saying we don't have an oncologist yet. We need to get an oncologist, basically. They're conceding that they needed an oncologist to prove these things. Now, once that wrongful death claim drops, then we get into the interesting issue, if the court needs to address it, which I don't think you do based on the causation, of the interplay between 41-085 and 41-100. The first complaint they filed said nothing about 41-100 at all. They've asserted an estate claim in the first complaint, and they asserted an estate claim in the second complaint. The problem is they've never asserted the appointment of a legal administrator or executor to bring that claim. And the statute very specifically says it's supposed to be brought by the administrator or executor of the estate. But oddly enough, when you go through it, and again, with understanding my causation arguments, where I don't think you have to address this, the first complaint that they filed back in, I think it was in March or April, in paragraph 31 of the complaint says that as a direct and proximate result of the aforementioned acts of the defendants, the estate of Clark P. Schmutz has suffered damages consisting of the cost of medical care, cost of funeral, and punitive damages in excess of $10,000, which is 41085 language, and that is what the estate claims under that. When they filed an amended complaint, paragraph 33 of that complaint, that as a direct and proximate result of the aforementioned acts of the defendants, the estate of Clark P. Schmutz has suffered damages consisting of the cost of medical care, cost of funeral, and punitive damages. We still don't have an established estate bringing any claim.
So there was no probate instituted to appoint an executor or administrator?
Right. There's no evidence of any executor or administrator being appointed, and the allegations themselves merely ask for the wrongful death's damages as opposed to an estate, established estate bringing a claim for wrongful death under 41-100. Where the difficulty comes in, again, without consideration of the causation arguments, if you make an allegation, okay, I've got a wrongful death claim here, and then you want to say, well, I've also got a 41-100. Well, even if the court were to take the position, well, maybe you can make an election, but at the point in time when you're going forward with the motion for summary judgment, you need to make an election at that point. You can't have two claims that really kind of clash with each other. 41-100 provides for damages like the heirs would collect in 41085 and does not provide for the estate making those other claims. You can't have both of those going forward at the same time.
Why isn't it like a case in contract where I sue in contract but I also sue for rescission of the contract? I'm allowed to plead inconsistent claims, and I get to the jury stage and there's an interrogatory that goes to the jury and you're forced to your election at some point in the case, but you're entitled to keep both balls in the air until you're forced to that point.
I think they're forced to that point when a motion for summary judgment is filed. If they want to raise that, okay, fine, we're not claiming death damages any longer. We're dropping all the claims for death damages, and we're going forward on 41-100, and here's our appointed administrator. The administrator's going forward. All of our children here are dropping their claims. There's a choice that has to be made at that point in time. And if it's a dispositive motion coming up, I believe that the plaintiff at that point has to make an election.
You don't think you can answer a motion for summary judgment on wrongful death that you didn't prove causation adequately, that whatever happened caused the death, but you want to say, okay, I oppose your motion for summary judgment on my wrongful death claim, but I also have my medical negligence claim, and I should be allowed to proceed with that one in the event I fail on my wrongful death claim. You don't think they can do that?
I think they've got to make an election at that point. If there's a dispositive motion on file, I think they have to make their election at that point. The difficulty in this particular case, in the factual setting of this case, is once there's a determination that there is no causation in the wrongful death, obviously that goes away, but automatically 41-100 goes away too, because the same causation arguments apply equally at that point in time. So they can't say, I guess you could say...
If you had an affidavit from an expert that said the failure to diagnose this caused him to not receive effective pain care and therapy that he would have received had he been properly and timely diagnosed, so you ruined the rest of his life. If you had that affidavit and you also had a defective affidavit on causing death, it would seem to me your medical negligence claim wouldn't fail just because the wrongful death claim failed.
I agree with you.
I think
if they have competent testimony, if one dumps out, they can at least make an argument. My position is they have to make that election at the time of a dispositive motion. Another argument I think can legally be made that the election is at the time you go to trial. I don't think you can go to trial on a necessarily with a rescission and a specific performance, that the inconsistencies of the arguments are the same type of inconsistencies you run into here. And when you have a dispositive motion, you're running into those same inconsistencies. You got to make your choice. Which one are you going on? Are you going on death, or are you going on a survival of a decedent's claim?
We don't have a case that really outlines this.
No, the Alsense case I don't really think is responsive to the questions you're asking right now. I really don't.
I don't either.
In large part because they didn't really knock out the wrongful death claim and then have that other one sitting there at the time. And so I think that there is a distinguishing factor there that I think does not address you, and there isn't a dispositive case on the point in the state of Nevada that I'm aware of.
Is there not elsewhere on this election, or is our statute...
Our statutes are a little late in the game, and a lot of the other statutes were already in place in a lot of other states. I started practicing in Nebraska, and I think they had those statutes before they had buildings there. But the practical matter is that the statutes here were kind of flipped around. I found a 1970 case that I started reading that I thought might change my mind, and I realized it was a completely different statute than the 79. So we're kind of feeling our way through it, maybe 30, 40 years later, but we're still sort of feeling our way through it on death cases, just because this doesn't generally come up. Most of the time you have an expert witness who says, in my opinion, if this had been done here, much less care, or he would have lived for another 5 years. Those are the standard cases that we get in this area. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a reason, this is kind of a hybrid case, and so that's the reason this has never been addressed.
Mr. Cotton, could you briefly comment, and I know you've got about a little over 4 minutes, on the race IPS issue and the loss of consortium issue, if you have anything else you want to add on that.
On the race IPS issue, it was raised for the first time on appeal. It was never asserted in the claims below. It was never asserted in the briefs below. No one's ever raised that claim. But the practical problem with their interpretation of 41A100, Section E, they're relying upon a section that says a surgical procedure was performed on the wrong patient, on the wrong organ, limb, or part of a patient's body. Dr. Seibel's procedure, first place, it wasn't a surgery. So that throws it out of the statute right there. It was an injection. A pain medication. It wasn't, he was addressing a chronic back problem. That is the appropriate remedy or treatment, if you will, for a pain management doctor, and he testified to that, and our expert did too, without contradiction, but that's the appropriate treatment for a chronic low back problem, which this patient had. So we don't have a surgery that pulls it out of there. It wasn't on the wrong part of the body. The doctor intended to address that chronic back problem. And so 41A100, insofar as Dr. Seibel doesn't apply, it also doesn't apply as to Dr. Bradford, because Dr. Bradford, my client, did no procedure, let alone a surgical procedure. He didn't do anything. They're alleging that he missed something, but not that he did anything affirmatively, that he cut into him, did whatever you want to talk about. Absolutely zero procedures by Dr. Bradford. So that statute, I don't think, would fall in. And then once again, I hate to sound like a broken record, even with res ipsa, we still come back to causation. It doesn't alleviate the plaintiff's burden of showing that somehow or another, if you found the doctor negligent, that in fact all of the damages and injuries were caused by the res ipsa. And so they kind of fall out of that at that point in time. Okay. That's about all I've got. If anybody's got any questions of Mr. Rath, I'd cede the rest of my time to him.
I do have a question regarding Dr. Seibel. Maybe it would be better addressed by your co-counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. And I think I can clarify one of the questions earlier on the prior order as well, which I think Justice Cherry and Justice Douglas had asked on the affidavit issue. With respect to Dr. Seibel, there was no affidavit from a pain management expert, and leave was granted to allow for that. That takes it out of the Borger analysis, I believe, because for Dr. Seibel, there was absolutely no affidavit. Therefore, Borger did not apply, and Dr. Seibel should have been dismissed at the outset.
That answered my question.
Oh, that answered your question?
Yeah. Okay. Did you renew the motion to dismiss?
We did not.
On that grounds, or did in connection with the second amended complaint?
What we did was they had a pain management expert.
Right.
And I think at that point our only option was a writ, which we decided not to bring a writ at that point. Do you have any other questions as to Dr. Seibel?
Just one. Dr. Fish seems to indicate that Dr. Seibel's treatment did not fall below the standard of care. Is that correct?
He does. Dr. Seibel is a pain management specialist. The patient was referred to him for pain management. The patient had severe degenerative arthritis of the spine and had back pain, and Dr. Seibel treated the back pain. As I think plaintiff's own expert has indicated, these nerve block injections can be used for palliative care for cancer as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You have 2 minutes.
Very briefly.
I would just like to make one observation initially. I believe that the type of cases that this alternative remedy issue would come up in a lot are medical malpractice cancer cases, misdiagnosis of cancer. I was thinking about that very question. That seemed like, at least in the medical malpractice context, somewhere where a clarification would be very important. I don't have anything specifically to cite, but I disagree with the contention that our experts did not say that Mr. Schmutz was able to unable to get the palliative care that was necessary. Another issue that I'd
like to... The only expert opinion on that point seems to be Brazier?
Yes, the anesthesiologist.
In which he makes a general statement that this delay affected the palliative care of the patient, but then he seems to defer on 517 of the record that it was outside his practice area to state to a reasonable degree of probability that the decedent's outcome would have been different. Is there any other affidavit besides Brazier that, in effect, provides a basis for causation on a negligence claim?
I believe that Knotts, Fink, and Brazier all factually established that he lost that opportunity. Not to mention the affidavits of his family members, as Justice Pickering had pointed out earlier. I would like to mention one more thing. The administrator issue that was just brought up, that was brought up by Mr. Rath in the very first motion to dismiss. It wasn't included in the order. The second motion for summary judgment that came out, the second dispositive motion, didn't mention it. Okay. I believe that issue is waived. It was not mentioned anywhere in the appeal briefs, and if the court is going to consider that, I would ask for supplemental briefing. Ultimately, the reason the medical negligence claims were thrown out is because the court made the ruling that they were derivative at this point of the wrongful death claim. And so she said they're out with the wrongful death claim because that's how I read Alsace. And the Scott case, I believe, clarifies that point better than Alsace does, and we disagree with that. So as far as the 56F motions that we were all discussing, if the court remands it on the medical negligence case, then that would be one of the things that we would have to consider doing to controvert their oncologist and hematologist. But we should be afforded that opportunity. That's all I have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The briefs and arguments were excellent. We appreciate your efforts. We'll stand in recess on this matter.